Well, hi, and welcome. This is Dave. I hope you guys are doing great. We have an echo. I'm going to call back.
It obviously is on my end.
My apologies, guys. I couldn't even get into my own bridge line. I hope you're all doing great. Thank you again for your kind words and comments that you sent. I want to spend just a few minutes, if you have questions or comments, to talk about directly before we move into our third seminar. Anything that you'd like to highlight or discuss very briefly or like to ask or add to what we've discussed before or for right now? Any questions or clarifications about anything? Well, while we still have an open mic, thank you for managing the background noise. I've had some suggestions about adding a bit more of case illustrations. And I wanted to add one in the beginning. It was just sort of fresh off the press. A mentor coaching client, I'll present a brief vignette to give you an example. And this is not to illustrate anything that would serve you well for ICF certification whatsoever, especially the first level where you're to only ask powerful questions. So this is the antithesis of that, but it'll give you an idea of why I call myself a mentor coach, that I can get away with doing other things. So this is kind of an unusual example, but it's from the standpoint of some of what we've been discussing. And this happened very recently. A mentor coaching client who was a successful, high-profile financial professional was about to meet with an important new client for the first time. And he wanted to collaborate about his specific game plan. And I asked him at the beginning, how long will your presentation and recommendation usually take? I realized that I didn't know what his standard framework was. He said, well, we're going to start at 10 in the morning. It'll be about 3 hours because it's a really complex investment picture. I then asked, when do you plan to have snacks or lunch served? And he was a little surprised. He said he hadn't really thought about it. I said, well, here's something to consider. A study of the decision-making characteristics of eight parole. You guys may have heard me talk about this. Can I get a management of the background noise? I'm hearing a little technostatic. I can go to mute, but I'd like to keep it open. A study in the decision-making characteristics of eight parole judges in Israel for a three-year period was reported in the National Academy of Sciences. The average parole rate was 35%. At the time when their blood glucose was lowest, right before lunch, just before the day ended, their parole rate was almost 0%. Right after lunch and just after the mid-morning snack, their parole rate was 65%. And he thought that was interesting, and he said, can you say a little more? I said, one more question. Where will you sit in relation to your client? He said, well, I usually sit at my desk, the client across. And then I told him two studies, Dr. Tomasi and Marzoli in Italy, showing that when someone speaks into a recipient's right ear, the positive response rate is 72% more successful than speaking into the person's left ear. So he out loud decided when he was going to serve a light lunch, where he was going to sit, and he reported at our next coaching session that he signed the client to manage an initial investment of $28 million. So this was simply indicating a couple of things that might have an influence in terms of their collaboration. I just wanted to share that with you to give you an idea of how goofy my mentor coaching can be, but to give you an application of how you might think about whatever, in my view, whatever is most useful for the success of your client. And that's why there are a number of things that we do in mentor coaching, as you just heard. So I wanted to open that as a possibility. Let me ask one more time before we move into our material. Any questions or comments about anything you'd like to make before we go on lecture mode and launch our discussion? Well, I'll reserve some time then at the end if there's anything you'd like to comment or ask about. Okay, I don't have from this venue here the option of doing lecture mode, so I'm going to ask if each of you will go on mute, star six, or a mute button, and we'll come back and have discussion in just a bit. So we've discussed the concept of your money story, your relationship with money, and the first three steps of change, how to recognize, own, and assess your money story. In this seminar, we're going to discuss the next two steps, decide what to change, and map changes of your money story. And remember, the roadmap is simply a systematic way for us as coaches to think about how we listen, how we understand, how we decide if we're going to respond in certain ways. It's not something that you ask your client to do or to fill out or in any way. It's just a response of information that I'm giving you to conceptualize this. So the fourth step, decide what to change in your money story here. So I'm going to describe a study and have you guess the biggest change impact. Ben Fletcher, the University of Hertfordshire in the UK, devised a study to get people to break their usual habits. Each day, the subjects chose a different option from polls of contrasting behaviors: lively, quiet, introvert, extrovert, reactive, proactive. They would pick one and then behaved according to what they chose for the entire day. So, for example, an introverted person, if they chose to act as an extrovert, would do that the entire day. Additionally, twice weekly, they had to stretch to behave in a way outside their usual pattern. They would eat something twice a week they had never eaten before, and twice a week they would read something they had never read before, a whole different genre or area of interest. So after 3 to 4 months, and this study was replicated, what do you think the biggest change in this group was? To them, to Fletcher and his group, they were astonished because they didn't expect this. The remarkable finding was that after 4 months, the subjects lost an average of 11 pounds. 6 months later, they had all kept the weight off. Most continued to gradually lose weight. And the researchers were baffled. This was not a diet, but it was a study focusing on change and its impact. The rationale: requiring people to change routine behavior made them actually think about the decisions they made rather than just doing a default choice, habitually choosing without even considering it. They became aware that every behavior was a choice. Most even came to consider that every bite they took of food was a choice, so they could reflect on whether that choice was in their best interest. So this is a kind of model, the essence of what we do in mentor coaching. When we break the script, we ask someone to reflect on what they're doing and focus on the choice architecture of this moment. Once becoming aware of actively making choices, you can decide on the most informed and strategic choice possible. And remember, your identity is not your behavior or your habits. A habit is not a definition. It's simply a choice that gets repeated, a collection of repetitions. If you define yourself by what you do or by your habits, it'll be harder to change. Every action is a choice. Every thought and feeling is a choice. So remember in last seminar, we talked about the equation belief drives behavior, behavior drives performance. For this step, to decide what to change, I want to add an equation. It captures the principle that we either create our reality or we agree to it. Event plus response equals outcome. Every outcome you experience in your life is a result of how you respond to a specific issue or event. Achievement is an ultimate outcome. It's the result of responding in certain ways. It's not what happens to us, but our response that makes the difference, that determines our story. Remember this essential principle for ownership of your money story, at least in adulthood. You either create or allow everything that happens to you. You worked out, so now you feel more energy and alertness. You didn't attend marketing, so now your business is slumping. You spent more than you earned, so now you have debt. Choice is part of a mindset. The antithesis of choice is also a mindset, with its own text. This is how that can sound. Fate, luck, circumstance, bad traffic, things just happen. I can't do it. The absence of the awareness of choice limits possibility. So that's one of the things we do as mentor coaching, and in mentor coaching is to open the possibility of choices by simply asking beyond where someone has been before. We break the script. We ask, is there more? Are there different ways to think about that? What else do you think about? What's the possibility here rather than the problem? So here's a kind of a footnote. Whatever you're doing that you can't control is your addiction. You can be addicted to a substance, a behavior, such as spending beyond your means, or to a process, such as debt, or a certain kind of relationship, or to compromised results. Money is energy. Anyone addicted to anything has difficulty regulating energy. So, here's another notion to consider. What you seek is camouflaged, possibly, by what you fear. Let me say that a different way. Show me an obstacle, and I'll show you a desire. For example, show me clutter, I'll show you blocked energy that desires release. We always create the outside to match the inside. So, in other words, instead of strategizing to overcome or avoid or defeat an obstacle in working with your client, get them to consider what it would be like to not create it. It's not there until you create it. Consider using energy to generate something else instead. Now, there's a secret here. An obstacle is the unconscious mnemonic of desire. It's created to remind you of what you want, but it may make it feel safe to want if you're afraid to pursue it. Here's an example. I saw a cartoon of a dog straining at its leash. In the first frame, barking fiercely at a cat. And the next frame showed the cat, at least as big and probably meaner looking than the dog. All of a sudden, in the middle of a ferocious bark, the leash snapped. So the dog was totally free to go after the cat. He looked back, astonished, scared to death. He quickly ran back, grabbed the leash, tied a triple knot. Then he could again safely strain at the leash and bark his fiery, just let me at him. So here's another example of this dialectic of obstacle and desire. When viewing a scene in a film you don't want to see, you cover your face with your hands as if to say, no, I can't look. But then desire creeps in and you peek through your fingers at what you're drawn to see. The obstacle makes looking acceptable. So when you find yourself or hear your client focusing on an obstacle, I can't find time to exercise, I can't put away money and savings, reflect on the underlying desire. And here's the coaching principle. When you're ready to consider that you create the obstacle, you're also ready to consider the possibility of not creating it. In other words, to focus on the desire only instead of the obstacle and to strategically plan that. Imagine what it would be like not to create the obstacle. The primary obstacles that people give for not participating, for example, in retirement plans include fear of finances, inertia, procrastination, other pressing financial demands. So the way you frame an issue makes a great deal of difference. Here's an example how framing establishes a way of proceeding and processing. When companies automatically enroll their employees in retirement savings plans, the employee in that structure has to opt out to to not participate, to actually make a choice that says, I will not save for my future. When in another framework, when it's automatic, it's 100% initially, then it levels to between 86 and 94%. At companies where it isn't automatic and someone has to choose to opt in, 20% participate. A four-fold difference just based on the framing. So this automatic way of doing it, a simple way is, for example, to make one good decision, to have set up a structure in which money is automatically drawn from your checking account at the beginning of each month, a specific amount, to go to your retirement savings. You don't have to think about it every time. You make one decision, and it can make a difference. So let's talk a little bit about change in the brain, because it's crucial to understand these aspects when we engage change and to really help our clients understand in a better way. And both our minds and brains automatically resist change. So let's first look at how our brains oppose change and then how we can use this information to facilitate success. And these principles, the neuroscience principles, they're in your outline. One, people have prior knowledge that affects how they hear and how they respond to new information. What this means is you can't just tell somebody information or facts or data and expect it's going to overwrite what's already there. And in working with clients, existing knowledge is the beginning of new knowledge. It's where new learning starts, because it can't happen any other way. Two, the prior knowledge is physical, real, and persistent as a neuronal pathway in the brain. And this is to say just a little bit differently what I just said. Facts, beliefs, information are an anatomical reality in the brain. They can't be removed or just overwritten by another fact. But they do atrophy with disuse as other networks take place. So what we do with a client is to activate new ways of thinking, new ways of considering, step by step, to create a different and systematic process of looking at possibility, at opportunity, rather than simply repeating a problem or trying to solve a problem. Three, if we ignore reality, it will get in the way of new information and change. So as we collaborate to co-create change, we have to start where the client is, not where we are, not with our suggestions or our advice. And people are not always aware of their prior knowledge. So your client may not be fully consciously aware of their entire operating system, or we'd be out of business. Four, when changes occur in a systematic and consistent way, new connections are made in the brain. New maps are co-created. So consider this in terms of how the brain opposes change, because this can be significant in terms of what we do collaboratively with a client. Since the brain has a mind of its own, we may need to consider how our brains work to strategically plan change with our clients. Each of these precepts, I think, might help you craft a new money story and listen to your client in a more informed way to facilitate change. The mechanisms are a little bit complex, but the principles are so simple they're almost elusive. One, change generates discomfort. Things that we've done that have become habits that we do automatically are hardwired into our brain. Neural pathways and neural networks, the highways and villages in our brain, have become etched by repeated habits to make efficient operation, to make routine behaviors easy. We don't have to think about how we drive the same way to work each day, because this default mode is operative after we've done it a while, so we can think about other things or listen to a book. It's also energy efficient because the brain's freed up to do other things. Now, when this habitual behavior is confronted and has to change, the automatic pilots in the midbrain get disrupted. Think about if there's road construction, you have to snake your way through it. You have to think about it. We feel discomfort. The prefrontal cortex, the thinking brain, has to get busy and use more energy and attention to process this thinking. So basically, it's work to change. The natural inclination is to resist the stress of change and preserve the default mode. The brain naturally resists change. That's its job description, to hardwire behavior that gets repeated to make it energy efficient. So the brain is going to oppose what has been adaptive from an evolutionary standpoint to repeat the same behavior. To change that, you're going to get pushback from the brain. The promise of change is to develop a new, better default mode. The brain just doesn't know that yet, so our minds have to lead the way. And we may have to collaboratively co-construct with our clients a different map, a different system. Some remarkable new research also shows that consistently repeating new experiences can even alter gene expression. Our beliefs even can turn genes on or turn them off. I've heard Ray Kurzweil in person say this: civilization advances by extending the number of important operations which we can perform without thinking about them. And that's also in his book, The Singularity is Near, When Humans Transcend Biology. Two, change creates dissonance. We see what we expect to see, what our radar has been coded for. In fact, when we don't see what we expect, the brain's error detection mechanism reads as if something's off, something's wrong. Our brains have an innate capacity to detect what neuroscientists call errors. That's simply the difference between expectation and perceived actuality. It registers as a sense that something's not quite right. Since a portion of our medial frontal cortex has the job description to recognize and correct errors, consider this example. What's the emotional expense of debt? The real expense of buying something you can't afford is you have to pay more for it. Then the emotional expense of your mind, the dissonance in your brain to recognize that spending is different from affording. Then you also have to pay interest. Triple work. You can deceive others, even your own mind, but your brain always knows. Now, the good news, this neural machinery can both recognize and correct errors to optimize behavior by responding to mistakes. So this is important for us to discern whether it's a mistake or it's simply our brain's response to change itself. Now, a very simple application is whenever your client makes any new step, something that's different beyond what they've done or been before, it may register with discomfort because it's a little bit different than the natural automatic habitual pathway in the brain. Now, it's important as coaches, when we hear that or sense that, that we can help our client understand that this trepidation or discomfort in doing something new and different is simply the way we naturally respond to moving beyond the default mode and a usual habit. If a client reads it as, well, you know, my gut's telling me that this isn't a good decision, or my intuition says, yeah, I better not do this. That's an accurate perception of discomfort, but it's a misread of what the discomfort actually means. So this may be helpful to empathically resonate, for example, with a client who's doing something different. Just recognize that it creates discomfort to do something new and different, no matter how much you know that it's the right thing and excited about it. So here's the number three in terms of understanding our brain. The brain is a prediction machine. I'd like to do an exercise with you briefly. I want to tell you some numbers, and I'd like you to write down what number. Can I get a management? If you came in late, I'm not able to do a lecture mode, so I'm asking everyone to do a mute, star six, or your mute button, just for background noise. Sorry, my arrangement isn't better. So I want you to write, I'm going to tell you some numbers. I'd like you to write down what you think is missing in this list of numbers. Here's the list. Again, I need a management of the background noise. Would you please go on mute or hit the mute button? My apologies for requesting that. Here are the numbers. 1, 2, 4, 5, 7, 8. What's missing? Usual responses, maybe 3 and 6, multiples of 3. Consider this. Nothing's missing. I gave you a complete list of 6 numbers. Everything that's there is there. What's missing, if you thought it was, is inside your head. It's informed by a pattern of expectation. Now, this is huge in writing a new story. Sometimes you have to outsmart your brain. When anything recurs 2 times in a row, the brain predicts a 3rd repetition. A stock goes up 2 quarters in a row, so the brain predicts a 3rd rise will follow. A company, this is a mini case study. The company has increased profits 26 quarters in a row with projected earnings growth to 24 cents per share in the current quarter. Instead, they announce an increase, but earnings of 23 cents per share instead of 24. They lose $1.5 billion in market value in 5 minutes. What changed? The company's value didn't change. Their growth curve didn't change. But the perception, based on the disappointment and the expectation, it was going to be a penny more. It was in the mindset of the investors. Here's a J. Paul Getty story. He said there are 3 key elements to getting rich. Get up early, work hard, find oil. So you can see how brain prediction of pattern is also the basis of a certain kind of joke. Listing 2 things, then a 3rd non sequitur. Set up, payoff. So our brains automatically impose patterns and predictions on repeated events. This makes it a challenge to override both emotion and brain patterns to make wise and balanced decisions. So what this means, among other things, we need to be sure we predict or envision the right things and recognize when change is not an error, a mistake, or intuition telling us wrong, but simply the printout of this is a step into the new and unknown. 4, behavioral reinforcements can backfire. Let's say you're the COO of a company determining a policy about employees being on time. What do you think works better, threats or reinforcement? The answer, both are likely to backfire because both focus on something that's negative. Threats work short-term to draw attention away from work back to the problem that created the behavior, and recognition for someone being on time actually raises anxiety and reinforces neural patterns connected with lateness. So we assume people will receive information about change and use it to better themselves. Not so, says the brain. In fact, being told what to do results in an innate opposition or pushback. The brain's natural homeostasis is to avoid change. 5. Motivation is not an essential component. Someone does not have to be motivated to do something. The professional athletes and actors I work with, they are not motivated to get up and go to the gym every day, but yet they do it simply because they know it's what they need to do in order to do what's next. So what they do is create a system, and they're loyal to the system, not waiting for motivation. In fact, a limiting assumption can be, well, I need to get motivated to work out or to save money, or I need to get comfortable first, as we've just talked. That can be a limiting assumption. All you need are two things, a plan and to stick to it. 6, emotions change brain functioning. When emotions are triggered, brain chemicals, dopamine and adrenaline, can prompt toward action and away from creativity and assessing what we know. So this means also that not only is a new or different neurochemical system involved, but it shifts to a different part of the brain than the more automatic responses, or at least in necessary instances, the considered intellectual reflection on this. When there's a possibility of a reward, dopamine is released for that pleasure chemical, anticipation of reward, a risky stock investment. It's been shown that when someone approaches a slot machine, when they're hooked up to an fMRI, the anticipation, as they sit down before they ever touch the machine, the anticipation releases the dopamine. It's not the reward chemical, it's the pleasure chemical, and it's the anticipation that does it. That's how when someone gets habitually responding to something like shopping, they're it's the pleasure at the anticipation of a purchase. And then to sustain that, even though there's the hedonic treadmill and it won't be as pleasurable the second time, they need to buy something else to sustain the pleasure. And a third thing. So the less predictable a reward is, the longer and stronger the dopamine neurons fire and create that natural high. For example, if a laboratory mouse is given regular predictable reward for pushing a lever, the behavior stops quickly when the food pellet reward stops. But if the food pellets are infrequent, unpredictable, the mouse will keep pushing the lever almost indefinitely. So this behavior is not confined to laboratory mice. Watch a bank of slot machines in Vegas, and you'll see the same scenario, complete with lever pulling and reward pellets. The moral here, if there is one. People easily fall into the unconscious pursuit of dopamine and its accompanying pleasure, despite the obviously illogical downside. 7, another brain principle here, stimulation and performance. Stimulation, also known as a little bit of stress, can enhance memory and learning, but the things that excite us, that provide a little bit of excitement or stress short term, while they can enhance learning, this time window is up to about 2 hours. The longer periods of time when stress exists for 4 hours or more, things head south, the other direction. Learning capacity declines. So that means with sustained stress, people can make bad, emotionally charged decisions. The most important success strategy I believe that we can help our clients with is to regulate states of mind and manage emotion to get grounded and centered prior to engaging any kind of process, especially decisions. Another brain principle, closure to novelty. Studies show that even highly accomplished people close themselves to novelty as they get older. Now, the major factor is not their age, but how long they've been doing a particular thing, such as been in a particular business. People who stay in one place and one position get most entrenched, because this becomes the automatic response. I see this resistance in coaching in family succession of business. The founder passes the company that began 32 years ago to two children to own and manage. It's a challenge. Everyone involved changes roles, relationships, and function. Now, these last two principles, I want to highlight them. They're huge in strategizing change. Neurogenesis is the creation of new brain cells. Two things above all others create the generation of new brain cells. Neurogenesis: an enriched environment and exercise. An enriched environment of intellectual and emotional stimulation creates more complex brain structure to co-create, to simulate thinking, to challenge, the story bust. That's exactly what we do in mentor coaching. The hippocampus is the part of the brain especially connected with two things, creativity and memory. Mice from an enriched environment have 15% increase in their hippocampal cells. Exercise increases the number of hippocampal cells especially connected to creativity and memory by almost 100%. And these studies have been replicated in humans in non-invasive studies in London taxi cabs and University of Hamburg medical students. Another finding, chronic stress impairs neurogenesis. The number of cells in the brain decline with chronic stress. And number 10, neuroplasticity. This simply means the brain remodels itself. This has been called the scientific revolution of our time. A region of the brain that originally had one job can be trained to perform another. The brain can reassign job descriptions of neurons. This is kind of like rezoning and developing cortical real estate. This is exactly what we help our clients do, to look at things and create a systematic way to proceed differently. When we write a new story and change our minds, we change our brains. Now, the step five, I want to talk just a bit about mapping changes. This is what we do in mentor coaching with clients, is to co-create a new systematic way to proceed given the client's focus and objective. A man approached J.P. Morgan back in the day, held up an envelope and said, "In my hand, I hold a guaranteed formula for success, and I'll gladly sell it to you for $25,000. This was over a century ago. That's when 25 grand was significant money. J.P. Morgan said, "Well, I don't know what's in the envelope, but if you show it to me and I like it, give you my word as a gentleman, I'll pay you what you ask." Well, considering the options, the man agreed to the terms, handed over the envelope. J.P. Morgan opened it, extracted a single piece of paper, gave it one look, and handed the piece of paper back to the man and wrote him a check for $25,000. There were two sentences on the page. "Every morning, write a list of things that need to be done that day. Do them." Still our formula for success. There are six crucial elements to map change. I want to briefly review each of these and how to understand and incorporate these into our mentor coaching, into your money story. One, regulate states of mind. This is a way, however you do it, whether it's a brief mindfulness meditation, a relaxation and focus, to get grounded and centered, to have access to all of your states of mind and to make a balanced decision. States of mind as we've talked before, are like software programs. They're a mind-body state that determine how we perceive and process information and how we respond. We each have a number of different states of mind: relaxation, alertness, anxiety, anger, centered attention. A key element is to be aware of our different states of mind, to know how to get grounded and centered, and then to select how we respond in an informed way, because different parts of the brain are involved in different mindsets, like creative writing versus editing. Two different states of mind, two different mindsets. Brainstorming versus completing a project. If someone's in an emotional state, they're overbalanced toward, sort of broadly speaking, right brain response, the feeling brain. And the emotional brain can even hijack the intellectual, logical brain and holds it hostage. So the first order of business, and something that I think is essential in what we do as mentor coaches, if this presents itself with our client, is to help them regulate a state of mind, to get grounded and centered. I want to reference something. It's a free webinar that you can access on the homepage of my website, MentorPath, M-E-N-T-O-R-P-A-T-H. At the very bottom of the homepage, there's a link you can click to directly access the webinar, Master States of Mind. And it's a 30-35 minute free webinar. It goes into a little bit more of an explanation and some examples of what we've talked about here that hopefully will be useful to you if you have a chance to do that. The number two element to map change, the power is in the focus. This is what we know from neuroscience, from quantum physics, and from mentor coaching. We help someone focus in order to create the initiation of a map to know where you are, and then with that focus, where they want to get to, the destination. With that map, then deter and distraction can be easily and quickly identified, and this is a system. And we've talked early and repeated that if you want to change, focus on the system, not just the goal. What we do in a coaching model is to focus on what the client wants to engage and focus on, where they want to get to. That creates a map for the coaching conversation. So the coaching conversation, each coaching session, whether it's 15 minutes or 50 minutes, is a coaching story. It's not just a slice of life where you jump in and both talk about the content of what somebody's dealing with, but you co-create a coaching story that's a different model, a systematic way to focus and develop a specific strategy and plan. So what we know is our unconscious doesn't register positive or minor, or negative, just the focus. The power of focus. Whatever you attend to or focus on, you align yourself to create. So be sure you focus on the right thing. Here are some bad examples. I want to get out of debt. Focuses on debt. I want to lose weight. Focuses on overweight. And here's one that's kept a lot of dry cleaners busy. I want to be really careful and not spill something on this new outfit. This is about aligning the energy field of the brain, getting grounded and centered to do that, and focusing specifically on creating, and from our perspective, co-creating a systematic way to pursue that specific goal for the client. You'll see in your workbook that accompanies, there's a chapter on visualizing changes that's reprinted there. This may be something that's helpful. It's simply a way to align the energy field of your brain, especially for people who are visually oriented, to look at creating a visualization and a systematic way to go about the visualization and the story that supports the visualization, the affirmations. The visualization is about rewiring your brain. The affirmations are about revising software. So visualization can crystallize possibility into an articulated idea. And the experience, when repeated, can change the brain. So a vision can simply serve as guide and inspiration to design ways to realize it, to live into it. 4, insight changes the brain. At the moment of insight, an aha experience, a complex new set of neural connections is created. 3 different parts of the brain light up on an fMRI scan at the moment of insight, at the aha moment. And that vaults someone into a more synthetic, creative, and integrative state. Now, consider that same fMRI of that same brain when someone is given information, a directive, an order, given facts. Nothing happens. No part of the brain lights up. So as important as this insight-induced change is, it's sustained attention and a systematic way of developing it that can ultimately be of most benefit. 5, take action. We ask a client at the end of a coaching session, what do you commit to do before we meet again? We know the world will not pay you for what you know. It'll pay you for what you do. It rewards action. So to analyze and plan are important. And then payday comes with action. Winners develop a plan, set it into motion, use a system to do it. May not be perfect, but self-correction and keep moving forward. Learning from mistakes, having a growth mindset can produce remarkable results. And 6, transformation of identity. A new experience or idea needs to be focused on consistently, frequently, creating a systematic way to proceed. When attention is consistent, brain circuitry is stabilized. When this process is complete, the mindset of identity then incorporates the new experience and integrates it as part of an evolving self, as a component of one's identity. This is an important aspect. We're going to spend part of our last seminar, the P of Roadmap is Program New Identity. It's that important to look at how we do this as coaches, because this can be what makes change permanent. If someone does something that's new and different, unless it's incorporated into, transformed into their operating model of how and who they are, their identity, they'll revert back to where they were before. So here's an application of steps 4 and 5. Deciding and mapping change. Let's apply it to your debt story. You can fulfill a desire you didn't know you had by spending money you don't have. You can define yourself by acquisitions not paid for. You can even borrow based on how much money you'll be lent rather than how much money you can pay back. Spending money generates the perception, both by the spender and the observer, of having money. The anticipation of spending boosts dopamine. Fulfilling a wish generates the desire. When desires become identity, that means they can become unrelenting. Many people who fall heavily into debt do not necessarily have psychological problems, but because spending takes on a life of its own. With spending, the chase is on. Then try to afford what you buy, and net money can never buy what it represents emotionally. The very first client, this was totally eye-opening for me, the very first client I had as a mentor coach was someone who I had collaborated with as a psychiatrist, psychoanalyst, and done. She was waiting until I made my transition to mentor coach and wanted to be my first client. She confessed to me, totally unknown to her spouse, that she had a debt, a credit card debt that she was juggling of $500,000. A very savvy, very professional woman who had just let this totally get out of control. This was something we initially worked on, and she did so successfully. But now, it's hard to save because the way our minds and brains work, and our brains are wired, I should say, it's hard to resist the immediate pleasure of buying because it activates the same pleasure center in the brain that generates dopamine. Spending money can be addictive. It changes the state of mind. And it's really difficult to substitute a theory, future need, long-term saving, retirement funding, for the immediate pleasure. The most common way we're short-sighted in our decision-making is that we choose a small amount of something right now rather than a large amount in the future. Here are some possibilities to counter those tendencies. Neuroeconomist Ben Seymour at the University College in London has shown that imagining a future purchase has the same effect in the brain as getting it. Saving can be easier when it's for something specific that we can envision. It's easier and more specific to create a distinct vision for a goal, like a college tuition, a vacation, a new house. Tangibly calculate the cost of debt so that it becomes real. Here's an example of something related. Concretely represent the magic of compound interest, as in a retirement fund. Figure out the money you'd spend now, what it would be worth in 5 years, in 10 years, at retirement. Here's an example. Investing $1.50 a day, beginning at age 20, based on the stock market average growth since 1926, by age 65 will be worth $1 million. Wait until age 21 instead of 20, the difference is $109,000. If you invest $2,000 a year in an IRA beginning at age 18, then stop all investment by age 30. At age 65, it would be worth $1 million. So here's an example how that can go in the opposite direction. Credit cards segment the pleasure of spending from the pain of future payment. Two different parts of the brain are involved. The pleasure center, and when you pay, it activates a part of the brain that is associated with pain of giving up something of your own. So that's why credit cards can segment purchase from payment. People will purchase 25% more minimum when they pay with credit card than if they pay cash or check. A recent study showed that credit card holders are actually consciously aware of only $4 of every $10 they owe. Not just bad guessing, but a total unawareness. This underestimation is a form of denial. Now, here's a final example before we stop. This is what an expert had to say. Uncle Junior to his nephew, Tony Soprano. You know, your father and me started that poker game over 30 years ago. We were talking one day about how the credit card companies, you know, they work their angle. How they don't care what you bought as long as you don't pay all at once. They juice you to death, and you thank them for letting you have a card. You'd rather be juiced than pay all at once. It's a certain kind of player. That's why they call it the executive game. So we render money an abstraction, and we deceive ourselves. Well, I can do it on my credit card, and it won't be an immediate expense. And as Richard Medley said, free money can make you stupid. So remember this from everything you've heard. Right now, saving and the future of both abstractions. There will be a time when they both become very real. So we have just a minute or two. Any thoughts or questions or comments you'd like to add or ask to anything we've talked about or even clarifications? I hope you're finding this applicable for yourselves, your work with clients. If you are taking the time, I hope you find it useful to do some at least of the exercises that you're seeing in the accompanying workbook. So if you have questions or thoughts, feel free to send me an email, and I promise to work in the discussion for our final time. So final call, any thoughts or questions or things you'd like to add or ask? Well, thank you all very much, and again, I appreciate your email comments. If there's anything you want to be sure we discuss in our final seminar next week, fire an email, and I'll be happy to incorporate that. Thanks very, very much. Take good care of yourselves. See you guys. Bye now.
Thank you.
See you now.